Sometimes taking a stand requires you take an arm stand. And to me, Max Blumenthal makes this point far clearer in this interview than Norman Finkelstein did in the interview I aired last week. I mean, colonized people have the absolute right to resist colonization by any means necessary. And that's something that this interview on the Empire Files, this episode of the Empire Files, definitely makes clear. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that now.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they've seen very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bire outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv, and Haifa, and all of the cities inside Israel's interior, where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa, with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they are reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and all of, and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been, traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
It has been another relentless day for the medics here, as casualties continue to pour in. Tragically, many of those are children.
Neema is just 2.5 years old. She was caught in a missile attack from an F-16. She has a broken nose and a fractured skull. She hasn't spoken a word.
We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
Doctors at the hospital here were unable to save Shahid.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground, and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shajaiya, which was you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes, and speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman, in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes, and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off, and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves. Interviewing the Rujela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair, and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real life horror film. And this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there, most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation? How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected, and in a surprise to a lot of Americans, after Operation Protective Edge, you have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72 to 80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans. And for the first time, you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
In the hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Allah.
It was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons are and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested. And the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and you know, some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shujaiya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shujaia, and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the US military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shujaia was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that you don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East: air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. So the Israeli military found it, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting, really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th, I might be getting the date wrong, they decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shujaia, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians, because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, you know, Fatawi, you know, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah, for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip, but I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs and that Israel had a shoot to cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli, this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill, they're more likely to cripple, they shatter bones, they often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinians, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal. in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society, you just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the state of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here because it's Washington and the US government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
Second time today, everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. Or some less humane fate. At least I've got to try. Every time I think about it, water rises to my eyes. Situation desperate, echoes of the victim's cry. If I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, some son of a bitch would die.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was Bruce Coburn with If I Had a Rocket Launcher. And before that, of course, we heard Max Blumenthal talking on the Empire Files with Abby Martin about the Palestinian rebellion and growing Israeli fascism. Now, and of course, all these things are really, even though that interview was done in 2015, all those things you could see playing out around in Palestine right now, like just even more pronounced than they were then, with the massacre of unarmed demonstrators in Gaza over the last few weeks. Now, one of the things I mentioned last week and on previous episodes of the show is the ongoing colonization of black people in North America and the role of racist police brutality, the role that racist police brutality plays in that. And seeing that on April 4th, we just had the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, an act which almost certainly was the doing of the American state, based on the evidence that exists. I'd like to play this recent interview, to close out the show with this recent interview from Eddie Conway of the Black Panther Party, examining the deep and racist roots of police violence, the deep roots that police violence has in America, the deep racist roots that it has. So I'm going to play that and... I'm going to round the show off with that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. And I do need to give my voice a rest here.
Welcome to The Real News. I'm Eddie Conway, coming to you from Baltimore. In the immediate aftermath of the killing of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, police justified their actions by saying that Clark was advancing toward them with a weapon, leaving the officers with no other choice but to shoot to kill.
Officers pursued the subject and located him in the back of the residence and began where he began advancing on the officers. The officers believed the subject was pointing a firearm at them. Fearing for their safety, the officers fired their duty weapon, striking the subject multiple times. The involved officers held their position for approximately 5 minutes until additional officers arrived. Officers approached the subject, handcuffed him, and began life-saving measures.
On Friday, March the 30th, an independent autopsy conducted on behalf of Clark's family revealed inconsistencies in the Sacramento Police Department's version of the incident, namely that Clark was not facing the officers when he was shot to death.
So the first shot he received would be number 7 to the left side and back of his chest. And the propulsion of the bullet and the injuries caused made him shove him around. And he turned around and his back was facing the officers. If you see the video, he was shot first. He turned around, projected him. And immediately he received a cluster of subsequent bullets. The proposition that has been presented that he was assailing the officers, meaning he was facing the officers, is inconsistent with the prevailing forensic evidence as documented at autopsy.
That same day, Baton Rouge police release the body camera footage of Alton Sterling's encounter with police. The video shows two officers making death threats and screaming profanities at Sterling before firing the fatal shots.
Bro, stop.
What I do? I'm saying what I did, son.
Don't fucking move on. Shoot your fucking ass, bitch. Put your fucking hands on the car. Put your hands on the car. I'm gonna shoot you in your fucking head. You understand me? Don't you fucking move. I'm gonna shoot you in your fucking head. You hear me?
Louisiana Attorney General declined to bring charges against the officers, claiming they were attempting to make a lawful arrest. To talk about this ongoing crisis of police violence and the protest that has erupted in response to it, I was recently joined by David Correa, an activist and author of Police, A Field Guide. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Could you start off first by talking a little bit about your book?
Sure. I recently published a book along with my co-writer, Tyler Wall, who's a professor at the University of Tennessee, called Police, A Field Guide, with Verso. And the book comes out of my own experience, not just as a professor, but as an activist working on anti-police violence organizing in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which just about 4 years ago, they shot and killed James Boyd, a homeless man, unarmed. Under similar circumstances to Stephon Clark in Sacramento and so many other people all over the country. And one of the reasons, so the book is kind of a, almost like an encyclopedia of cop terms, like threat and emergency and taser and police helicopter, almost 100 terms. And the point of the book is to get at what we call cop speak. Really everything we think we know about police and the words we use to talk about police comes to us from police. You know, cops don't just patrol our streets, right? They patrol the language we have to talk about police. And we wanted to write a book that gives activists a different language, because after a murder, and I'm going to call what happened to Stephon Clark a murder, after a police murder, like what's just happened in Sacramento, what usually happens is the forces of police reform seize hold of a community. It happened to mine in Albuquerque. And the language and the talk starts to focus on things like police training and police hiring.
We will begin tonight, and April 10th specifically, with a rigorous and honest public discussion about the numerous questions of policy, protocol, and training that arose out of the police videos released last week.
And generally, this has nothing to do with confronting the problem of police violence or confronting the very real fact of histories of police violence against poor people of color. Rather, it's just entirely about reinforcing the legitimacy of police in general. They will say explicitly, we want to restore the community's confidence in police. That's what reform is about. It's not about confronting the very real problem of racialized police violence in our country. It's just about blunting the anger of activists and family members of people killed by cops. And it ensures that this is going to happen again. And our book is an effort to try to confront that and interrupt that language and give us a shared language to really transform the racialized patterns of policing in this country in ways that police reform never will.
Okay, we'll revisit that, your book again later on. Right now, can you give me kind of like an update or overview of what happened in Sacramento?
Well, you know, what happened in Sacramento is pretty, anyone that lives in California, particularly Southern California, knows the familiar sound of police helicopters over their homes. There was probably no state in the United States with more police helicopters flying above it than in California. Actually, LA County and the LAPD have the largest police helicopter units in the U.S., in the world, really. So what happened to Stephon Clark was similar to what happens every day in LA and even in Sacramento and Northern California, which is which is this intense property policing, in which the cops identified some suspect and decided to unleash the sort of full force of the police force. They were chasing a suspect on the ground and in the air. They finally located someone who they thought was a suspect. It happened to be Stephon Clark in the backyard of his grandmother's house, and they shot at him 20 times, killing him. He was, of course, holding his cell phone, which is a common story about police killings, a man with no weapons, holding a cell phone or a wallet, as we know from Amadou Diallo in New York years ago. There have been, as anyone who's watching this is probably aware, protests in Sacramento since the March 18th killing of Stephon Clark, in which Black Lives Matter activists and others have shut down the town. They shut down the city council meeting. They've been circling the police, the basketball arena, refusing to let people in. Providing, I think, a direct challenge to business as usual. Because that's what police violence is. Police violence is business as usual. And the activists have really directly challenged that business as usual. And that has continued even after Stephon Clark's funeral the other day.
Okay, it seems to me that the team, the Kings, who obviously was impacted by this protest, it seems like they have stepped up and joined in with the Black Lives Matter movement and protests to do something. You think this will have any kind of change on public attitudes?
I hope so. And as long as the players of the Kings are the ones leading this alliance with Black Lives Matter and not the ownership of the Kings, then I think that's a real and meaningful change in the way that this protest is developing versus other protests. Because, historically what generally happens in protests over police violence is local community leaders, Chamber of Commerce, business leaders, political leaders, will align themselves with the police and the forces of reform. And as long as the Kings, particularly the players, align themselves with the family of Stephon Clark and the activists demanding an end to police violence, then I think this could be a really meaningful thing.
Okay, I noticed also in just this month, March, there's been protests, and this is above what happened and outside of what happened in most cases in Sacramento, in Texas, in North Carolina, in New York, in Chicago, in Illinois, in Ohio. Are you keeping up with this kind of stuff? Are all these protests that's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not involved in any of the political organizing in cities outside of Albuquerque, police violence. I think what people need to realize is that, these are there's no coordination, really, between all of these protests all over the country. These are local issues that are the same no matter where you are. And so the fact that we have, another summer developing with widespread protests against police violence all over the country says a lot more about the problem than it does about the organizing against it. What it tells us is that police violence isn't going to go away no matter how much reform the Department of Justice promises us. It's not going to go away based on any of the reform that local police departments promise they might engage in. The only way to transform it, I think, is to confront it the way we've seen the last, I think, 5-6 years, and we're seeing again this spring and summer, which is organized protests in city after city after city, confronting both the specific issues like the murder of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, but also what really I think gives purchase to all of these local protests is the fact that there's long histories of police violence against poor people and poor people of color everywhere. This is not isolated to Sacramento or Ferguson or Baltimore or New York. This is everywhere. And the fact of these protests everywhere is indication of that.
One of the things I noticed when I was looking at the background of this story is that in the last 4 years, 2,356 protests have took place across the country, and it still haven't had any kind of real impact on the police or the police behavior. What's the, I noticed in the book you talk about capitalism a little bit and the police being the front line. Is that the systemic problem here? It's not just that they need training or they need to behave themselves or they need to love the citizens. What's the real problem? Why do they keep doing this?
Well, in our book, I think what we're trying to do is point out to provide a language to talk about police that lets us get past this sort of assumption a lot of people bring to their understanding of police, which is that police are here to serve and protect us. And when they don't, when they do something outrageous, when they do something like they did in Sacramento and murder Stephon Clark, that represents an aberration of an otherwise progressive and important institution in society. And the point we want to make in the book is that when you talk about police, you're not talking about law, you're not talking about crime fighting, you're talking about order. The job of police is to impose order. It's to literally fabricate the order. And we should ask, when we talk about police, well, what order is it? And first of all, it's an order based on property. It's not an accident that the police were out to find Stephon Clark because of what they consider a property crime. They were looking for somebody they claimed who was breaking car windows. It's often property crimes or the police effort to police property crimes that brings them into contact with people they eventually will harass, arrest, or kill. So if we're talking about order and not crime, and we're not talking about law, then we ought to ask, what is the order of police? And it's a racialized order of property, right? Police defend property rights first and foremost, and they patrol the color line in this country. And those two things are conflated in the world that police operate. So, but there's this idea that police, no, there's some sort of difference here. Police are on the public payroll, but police on the public payroll are no different than the cops on the private payroll, the security guards that we might more readily recognize as serving specific economic interests, the people that pay the private police salaries. But let's just remember that the police, the public police, the ones we think serve and protect, don't serve and protect everybody equally. They serve property owners primarily, and they patrol a color line that is related and conflated with those questions of property. So, but despite all those protests you're pointing out, I don't think we can point to any police department and say, oh, this police department has resolved the problem. This is the one police department that has finally transformed itself away from these patterns of racialized policing. And the reason that can't happen is because that's not what police is. Police is an institution of the racialized control of poor people of color. And until we understand that, the language of reform will do nothing but what it intends to do, really, which is just restore confidence in police. That's the job of reform, not to confront the problems that we recognize historically and ongoing, but just to restore the confidence in police so that they can return to the job they've been doing. And so in every sort of reform process that's developed in every city that I've looked at, the result is the same. And often reform really means more cops, more weapons, an expansion of the police powers generally into the lives of poor people of color. That's what reform really means, and that's what we're trying to interrupt in the book.
Well, let's talk for 1 minute about your book. You kind of like give the definitions for activists so that they can recognize police speak or double speak or whatever you want to call it. But how do you see this book aiding and activists going into the future in terms of making change?
Well, you know, I've been following what's happening in Sacramento, and I think one similar thing that happening in Sacramento that happened in Baltimore, that happened in Ferguson a few years ago, was that there's this really intense anger, and rightfully so, by family members and friends and other activists who've been working on this issue so courageously and for so long. And then in the past and other places, what I've seen is the equally as intense effort by elected officials, by appointed officials to convert that anger and that commitment against police violence, that absolute political desire to end racialized police violence, into something else. And it's through promises of reform. We'll fix the police, we promise. We will raise our training and hire our and improve our hiring standards, and we'll give police cultural sensitivity training, and we'll use more non-lethal weapons. And those promises aren't promises that fool a lot of activists who know better, particularly family members of police, people who've been killed by police. But they fool enough people, or they convince enough people it's worth a try, and they're willing to believe that police reform might do something. Because what else can we do? We can't abolish police, is the idea. We have to do something. And so we end up engaging in these reform processes that don't ultimately do anything. If our goal is to end police violence, reform's not the route to it. Remember, there's no justice for Stephon Clark in the law. The law explicitly endorsed his killing by police. And so if there's no justice in the law, then there's no justice in reform. And there's no way to end police violence through the sort of official avenues of reform. We have to build popular movements against police violence that refuse the language of reform. And that's what the book is trying to do. The book offers definitions of terms that cops use and reformers use, and tries to reveal them for what they are, right? As not avenues for redress for people confronting police violence, but as kind of like Trojan horses into movements to diffuse the anger and the commitment against police violence. So the book it's called Police: A Field Guide, and it really is a field guide. It's meant to be a guide that you can use on the street and in organizing meetings to figure out ways to both understand what do they mean when they say threat? What do they mean when they say unarmed? What do they mean when they say justified? How should we understand the taser? What is the police dog really? All those terms are defined so that we can have a shared language, which isn't one the police give us. And it also, the whole book is premised on the idea that, like, we all have a cop in our head. Like, we've all been raised to believe, many of us, not all of us, but many of us are raised to believe that the police institution is an intrinsically good institution that is made bad by a few bad apples or a few mistakes by leaders. And as long as we fix it, we can solve the problem. And our book rejects that premise and instead says, no, the police institution does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's not an accident that if you're opening your eyes, you're seeing a pattern that goes back as far as anyone can remember of the police killing of young black men and indigenous men and women and Chicano men and women. And that's not an accident. That's what police is designed to do.
Okay, well, I'm sure your book will be a valuable resource to activists across the country. And thanks for sharing that information with us. And thank you for joining me.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me, Eddie.
Okay, and thank you for joining The Real News.
You have heard this poem before. You have heard the unoriginal, repetitious poetics of a shot, of a shot, of a shot, singing the night air of shell casings on concrete, then cases of claims of standard police procedure, and cases of batons that leave red and white and blue on black, and bullets in brown bodies, and bullets in sleeping bodies, and bullets in running bodies, and bullets in bodies holding umbrellas or holding pens or holding other things that look like guns or holding some last breath as if expecting dignity, service, and protection. This is another poem about police brutality. You will hear the same sets of metaphors once more. White security, verdicts of innocence, inconsequential bodies of evidence, ballistics and emergency lights, repetitious circling around and around like circular stories, like unoriginal poems, like a red stream of consciousness flowing through senses punctured, like sentences punctuated with bullet-like precision again and again. There is really nothing new here. This is as unoriginal as a mundane, untouched sheet of white paper or granddad's white clan sheets untouched in closets beside uniforms or uniform otherwise spotless police records. You have heard these stories before, I imagine. So why write? Why bother? Why do pens and tongues and lungs feel so heavy when stories seem to repeat themselves? Entertainment markets demand innovation. The same story again and again gets old, I am told. We'd rather plug our ears, and so there is silence in waiting for newness to appear. Silence. Like the eerie stillness of a loop, of a circuit frozen in time. Like prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to perfectly prosaic, perpetually profitable prison industrial strength. Complex loops like stock ticker tapes circulating at the bottom of TV screens. An economics of morbidity, a market that demands an endless supply of unremarkable names. Like Kenneth Chamberlain, like Rodney King, like Freddie Villanueva, like Amadou Diallo, like Katherine Johnson, like Neil Stonechild, like, are you tired yet? Then put down your scorecards. Set your aesthetics aside. There will be no originality tonight, because the same old stories out there mean the same old stories up here. So this will stop being cliche when that stops being cliche. When cliches are no longer scripted in blood, stuttering his last breaths alongside walks. Until then, chuck this up as one more outline, another empty shell of a thing, just one more, an original poem.
Bring that shit!
It's Steph.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Malvina.
I'm Ben, and we're hanging in the studio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Guelph Black Heritage Society wants to continue their celebration of freedom with a tribute to the minister and activist on Thursday, April 12th. The evening will begin with a spoken word performance, followed by a screening of the short film The Witness from the Balcony of 306. The evening will conclude with a performance by artist, singer, and songwriter Dave Archer. Doors open at 6:30 p.m., and the event starts at 7. Admission is $20 and includes one drink ticket. Tickets are available at the door or online at eventbrite.ca. Come out and celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with the Guelph Black Heritage Society on April 12th at the Art Gallery of Guelph, 358 Gordon Street, a physically accessible location.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
From April 6th to the 21st, the Guelph Little Theatre invites you to experience The Ghost Island Light. Written by renowned Canadian playwright Peter Cawley, it is an emotional roller coaster that'll have you sitting on the edge of your seat one moment and laughing your head off the next. This is the story of a lighthouse keeper, his beautiful young wife, and his charming assistant as they are stuck on a barren rock island.